Open Paddock Umcast. Of course, we're going to recap the 100th running of the Indianapolis 500-mile race. Stands to reason, since most of us were there, after all. There was also this little soiree in Monaco for Formula One, and we'll listen to Tom tell us all about it, since we were a bit preoccupied. This is Open Paddock. And I think that was the shortest intro I've ever done. Good evening, gentlemen. A full group tonight. How are you doing?
Doing well.
Very well.
A little tired.
So
a lot tired, if I'm honest.
Well, that stands to reason. You have every right to be. Let's go around.
No, wait. We can back that up just a little bit. Doug has a little less reason to be than the rest of us who had to go back to work.
Fair enough.
True debt.
So let's go around the table. That is the honorary Professor J. Douglas Patterson. What's in your cup, sir? Would it be a glass of fuzzies?
No. You know, okay. So what I should have done is I should have gotten just a regular glass, a regular bottle of fuzzies. It's just pretty difficult to find around here in the Kansas City market. But I did pick up a bottle, you know, the commemorative bottle of fuzzies, but it is autographed by both Fuzzy and by Ed Carpenter.
Ooh.
That bottle is not getting opened.
Yeah.
That's going into the shadow box with all my other 100th running swag.
Fair play, sir.
So what are you drinking?
I am drinking a Tanqueray martini.
No.
It tasted so cool and clean. It almost made me feel civilized.
Almost. How about you, Mike? Are you having a glass from your commemorative bottle of Fuzzy's vodka?
Well, similar to Doug's situation in that the lack of availability of Fuzzy's. And here's actually a short little funny bit of information. I had tried actually to find Fuzzy's at our local liquor store a year ago. And it wasn't there. And I ended up, I don't know if it was social media or something like that, said something about it, and maybe I emailed them, but Fuzzy's got back to me and saying that, well, you should be able to order it in your state. And I never went to the liquor store and asked them to order it specially for me, you know, because it just seemed like too much hassle, and I don't go to the liquor store all that often. Anyway, so I let it be. So when I went to get my commemorative bottle this year, or actually it was when we were at the track and we had got those Fuzzy's lemonades, that's right. So you get a vodka lemonade right there, you know, one of the stands. And the lady tells me there that, oh, you didn't know? Fuzzy's vodka actually is distilled in Bend, Oregon.
Nope.
So I can't get the Fuzzy's vodka that's made in my own state? What? Then a little bit of research after I got home, I find out that Crater Lake vodka is pretty much the same thing as Fuzzy's vodka. They just are a partnership and whatnot, and they sell it as Fuzzy's vodka elsewhere in the country.
So I guess I can get it.
I just don't get the cool label.
Well, that's good. So are you having some Crater Lake vodka?
Actually, I'm finishing off. I have some vodka to go through. My father-in-law, who bought a fifth of Absolute, was never going to drink it all. He gave it to me, and so I've got some Absolute vodka with some muddled mint because that was in the yard and fresh. With a little bit of lemon juice and a little bit of water in there. That's about it with the vodka.
Oh, very nice.
So it's very light and refreshing, and it's warm out here. We're going to be hitting supposedly 100 degrees this weekend in Oregon in the first of June.
Oh, boy.
But it'll be a dry heat? No.
Well, in comparison to where we were, yes. Yes, it will.
Well, yeah, I guess so. So how about you, Tom? What is in your cup?
I've got water, actually. Incredibly boring, but it keeps me awake. I did just finish, like, a pack of biscuits, though. And for Matt, the American translation to this is cookies.
Oh, there you go. hey, cookies at your time in the morning, 3 o'clock in the morning, I think that's a fine snack. So there you go.
It is.
Anything good for you, Matt? You told us already, so... Okay.
Well, but it's a surprise for everyone else. I am drinking a delightful beer called Black Duck Porter. It is a local Long Island beer that is made just about an hour from me, and I can actually get. So sorry, Mike.
Mike's the only loser there. Much like Mike and Doug, I have not cracked open my commemorative bottle of fuzzies, but I'm also having, I'm just having a couple of fingers of Three Olives vodka straight up.
Oh, well done. That's proper.
Yeah, that's all good. Yeah.
Oh, I missed the memo. I didn't realize we were getting fancy tonight.
Well, we all had nifty commemorative bottles that none of us were drinking from.
Right.
It looks too damn good.
It does. I will say I am being a little bit fancy, and then I'm going Tanqueray as opposed to my traditional New Amsterdam I remember your brother-in-law, Kevin Neely, he would have chastised me for.
Yes. I think he did once or twice, actually.
Yes, he did. And so every time I pick up a bottle of New Amsterdam, I remember his chastisement.
Do you feel a little twinge of guilt?
No.
Okay. It's okay then. So, digging into anything of any kind of a four-wheeled substance, there was this little race in this little principality, bejeweled by royalty and celebrity, in the whale-heeled in Monaco. Is that how it's pronounced?
Not Monaco.
It is if you're Stirling Moss. Otherwise, it's Monaco, generally.
I don't have the honor of being Sir Stirling Moss, so Monaco it will be. We were kind of at a disadvantage for Monaco because, we're like tied up in Indianapolis. So the only updates that I had were text messages I was getting from my wife. And at some point, the crowd got enough to overwhelm the cell service there at Indianapolis, and I was kind of kicked off the network, and I had nothing.
Case in point, this is called the Verizon IndyCar Series, so there's no boosting of AT&T services.
Yes.
I was going to mention that. I know AT&T had some boosters there, but it was still overtaxed.
Yeah.
They had their booster out outside of Lot 2. Of course, Verizon gets theirs on top of the pagoda.
They didn't get swallowed by the snake pit.
Yeah.
Yes.
When we on Carb Day, when we were there, when we were on the pit side grandstands, there were microcells mounted underneath the grandstands.
Yeah.
There. So, yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. And wasn't that a brilliant place to watch the Freedom 100?
That was beautiful.
That was awesome. We'll get to that. We got the whole.
You're getting ahead, Doug.
I know
you're all interested in the time-space continuum, but let's keep it in check for a few minutes, okay?
Okay.
What we know about the Monaco Grand Prix this year was that it started off wet and behind a safety car, right?
Right.
Take a step even before that, qualifying. We know that Ricciardo got the pole, which was surprising. But that was dry conditions.
Yeah, the rain didn't show up till race day, I believe.
This is true.
Also, not quite that surprising. He's been somewhat quick for the last two events.
True. And there is that Adrian Newey design chassis underneath him, which Monaco isn't so much a race that's determined by pure speed. Power. Yeah.
Power.
So. It's a pretty parade in a pretty place.
My moniker has always been, it's the Grand Parade of Monaco.
On a track that, interestingly, if it wasn't for nice waivers from Formula One, would be about grade 3 on the FIA list.
Probably wouldn't be good enough to race Reliant Robins on.
The Formula E race that they did there, I know they used like a slightly different layout because they went down a different street, but that is actually grade 3 track on the FIA, which is interesting because it was the same layout.
There are some events that you watch or you attend and you enjoy because of the fantastic racing, right? And then there are those races that you watch because of the pageantry and the event of it, right?
Agreed.
Monaco is that latter. You watch it, you're enthralled by it, you enjoy it for the event that it is and the production that it is, not because the racing is super awesome.
It's
awesome, and that's what makes it enjoyable.
Which is we always compare it to Long Beach, right? It's the same. It's got the Hollywood kind of deal there, right? And all the pageantry and stuff, although obviously higher class than I would say that Long Beach is. But
yeah,
you know, instead, it's a, you know, you're talking about a concrete tunnel that they're racing through.
Well, I can say Long Beach, from personal experience, is absolutely not a high class event. It is dirty.
There is some fascination as well in seeing F1 cars around Monaco, even on TV, just the kind of feeding it through the streets at the speed they do. It is quite impressive in its own right.
It is. And, you know, in order to do a fast lap around Monaco, it takes courage and it takes millimeter precision.
Yeah.
Right? You know, most tracks you say you have to be inch perfect. At Monaco, you need to be millimeter perfect. The confines are so tight, and to watch masterful driving and racecraft at work is still a glorious thing. I still love watching the onboards of Ayrton Senna in the wet at Monaco.
You know, I'd say there's one other thing that I guess gives Monaco so much more credibility, I guess, maybe than other street courses, is it's got character in that there's massive elevation change.
Mm-hmm.
And that's one thing that I definitely enjoy about pretty much any race course, is having that elevation change does add another layer of challenge. And it just, you know, you get those great shots, too, when they're coming down through the that carousel, the sharp hairpin. I don't remember all the names of all the turns, sorry.
The Lowe's hairpin, or whatever it's called nowadays.
What you just called it, yes. You know, in F1, they name every darn turn, and I can just remember Rasgas before the straight. But
to be fair, the hairpin depends on when you were born, on what you call it, generally, because it's named by the hotel, but its most famous name is Lowe's hairpin. So that's kind of what everyone knows it by.
You know, the other thing that I find fascinating about Monaco is because of this circuit, because it is so tight and twisty, the teams have to change the cars substantially. They need a different steering box. They run steering boxes at Monaco that they don't run anywhere else, in order to handle the very slow, very tight corners that they have to there. Things like that make Monaco maybe not necessarily better, at least in terms of the racing, but so much different than anywhere else. It's a monkey wrench in the preparation for the teams because it is so different in that way, if that makes sense. So, so you saw the race, Tom. What happened?
I did. Ricciardo went off into the lead at the start, and everybody else got stuck behind a very slow Rosberg, who seemed to have no grip. And I think they said gearbox issues eventually is what they came back with, including his teammate. And eventually Mercedes sent out an order for him to let Hamilton through, which he did. And then basically from there on out, it was Hamilton catching and following Ricciardo around for a while. Kimi crashed and then had to drag the wing through the tunnel, which went down really well with race control.
I remember seeing replays of that. That was the shower of sparks was very pretty to see, but the grinding sound of that wing through the tunnel was not a good sound.
Not mention laying a bunch of shards of debris for everyone's tires to pick up.
Woohoo!
Mm-hmm. Kimi's incident also ended up blocking Grosjean, so that pretty much ruined his race. And then the pit stops came and Red Bull, well, they screwed up. They weren't ready for Ricardo. It was sort of like a Sunday afternoon, sit down and watch the rest. Oh, wait, our car's in. Oh, crap.
Were they by any chance eating ice cream?
I don't know, but it was pretty much just everyone just sort of came out of the garage suddenly like, oh, yeah, the car's here. Excellent. Anyone got any tires?
Did you see the alternate angle for that? There was a video taken from the pit stall next door.
I didn't.
And I forget what the title is, but basically the backup lollipop guy, the guy in the front jack, he was shouting into the garage the entire time Ricardo was coming down pit road.
Wow.
Just pleading for tires.
Wow.
Yeah, anyway, it didn't come up on the main broadcast, but I saw that video a day or two ago.
Interesting.
Ouch.
Anyway, because he had quite a substantial lead, he came out just behind Lewis, but that was basically it done then. He tried to overtake, but yeah, there was sort of one option and struggling for grip. Lewis blocked him a bit and that was it. So, and then from there on out, it was basically follow the leader. And then Sauber had its fun with Ericsson and Nasr running into one another after the team told them to swap positions instead of swapping positions to drive into each other.
Weren't they being all childish? I don't want to let him by.
Yeah, pretty much. So they were arguing over the radio about it, and then suddenly just smacked two Saubers into the with bits of stuff everywhere at Massenet. So that was pretty much their race done. They parked one car straight away, and the other one had a very convenient issue a lap later and had to pull into the pits.
What's the number one rule in racing?
When you crash, get the team to turn off your car for you. And Kvyat had a terrible race. He collected Magnussen, which was about how Kvyat's career is going right now.
So he's still playing Mortal Kvyat then?
Yeah, pretty much. So I assume that he's out at Red Bull at the end of the year now. I mean, it was pretty obvious that it wasn't going to last anyway, but I don't know. Not exactly covered himself in glory since disappearing back to Toro Rosso, has he?
No.
And Palmer crashed. That was weird.
That was the one off of the paint, wasn't it? The paint in a pedestrian crossing?
Yes. Yeah, that was the one that he said was the paint, and the team look was a bit different of... what the hell are you doing? not a good race for Renault with both cars out. And I don't think Palmer's going to be there by the end of the year, honestly. And the other only interesting thing that happened at Monaco all weekend was that a manhole cover lifted up and Button went into it.
Wait a minute. He went into the manhole?
No. He hit the cover, which was raised, and ripped the front wheel off.
Oh, okay. I was going to say, if the manhole cover was off and he, like, dipped a wheel in the manhole, that would be disastrous, but, you know, probably entertaining to watch.
So, what, like, driven?
Well, I will... yeah, I will say this, though. Button got very, very lucky that he didn't drive over it square. He ended up clipping it with sort of the end plate of his wing and driving over it with the wheel, but the manhole cover was thick enough to cause some serious damage to the barge board, which could hurt his tailbone. Let's put it that way.
Yeah.
Did someone forget to weld it down?
Presumably. It's not that infrequent. Barry Keller ran into one about 5 years ago there. There's been a few others in the past. So,
well, holy crap, man. Isn't there a checklist?
Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, seriously.
I mean, it's not like this is an infrequent event. They go back to Monaco every year.
Right, and there can't be that many manhole covers, right? I mean, you know where they are. So it shouldn't be difficult to do a track walk. Oh, look, there's a freaking manhole cover. Let's weld it down.
Yeah, it's been weird. Did anyone see the picture of them dropping the car at the Monaco Historic from the crane?
I did see that, yes.
Yeah, that looked painful.
Oh, that was painful.
Yeah. What was it, like 30 feet?
It was a McLaren, right?
Yes.
Yeah, it was a McLaren.
It was about 30 feet up, just came off of the hook or disengaged the hook and fell flat on the tarmac.
Pancake.
More or less. The one good thing about that story, though, not that there's anything great, I guess it's an upside, but that car isn't privately owned. It's owned by McLaren.
Which means whoever dropped it is now underneath the lake at McLaren Technical Center.
Yeah. I mean, why do you think they call it McLaren Special Operations? What do you think they do?
Yeah, there you go. So down at the bottom of the lake, along with all the stolen Red Bull trophies, perhaps? No.
The manual for the Ferrari from
Spygate. Oh, that too. Yes. Yeah. There's probably all sorts of interesting things down at the bottom of that lake. Anyway. So when did the manhole cover issue?
That was
happen?
Friday.
That was Friday practice. Okay.
Yeah.
Okay. So no issues during qualifying or the race, which is
no, not really. Better.
So it sounds like the free practice,
just the weather.
Verstappen crashed in qualifying and in the race, so that went well. Or was it practice? No, it was practice in the race, wasn't it? He didn't crash in qualifying. No, I think.
So he is no longer the wunderkind now?
Of course he is, but not this week.
Mm.
But it's quite funny, isn't it, they sort of dumped Kvyat after a bad race. And yeah, Max, this is kind of like, yeah, and? So, what? It's sort of a bit double standards, really.
No, I agree with the double standards. It makes me wonder, who brings the bigger check to the table?
The Verstappen family.
Yeah, they've got some deep pockets, definitely. So.
Well, it's not just that. It's if they dump him, Ferrari take him.
Well, does the family want him at Red Bull, or do they want him at Ferrari?
Probably will have him at whichever team will give him a decent car, and he can potentially win it, probably.
Yeah, that makes sense.
And eventually Ferrari, because who doesn't want to race for Ferrari eventually?
True. I think that's every Formula One driver's, you know, ultimate goal. Even when Ferrari is not at their best, drivers still want to drive for a Ferrari, right?
Right. It is what it is, really. You're a national hero of Italy, I suppose, if you drive for Ferrari, especially if you win a lot.
Yes. Well, that's kind of the key, is winning a lot, isn't it?
I guess.
Well, there's all sorts of exceptions there. So, brief rundown on finishing order. Lewis Hamilton won the race. His first win of the season for the champion, which is very uncharacteristic for him. But, Rosberg's been on a huge roll. So, Ricardo and Perez rounding out the podium.
Yes, very good run from Perez.
Very good. As well as Nico Hülkenberg, too. Both Force Indias have been kind of nowhere. Until Monaco?
No, they pitted and changed the tires to slicks at exactly the right point, to be honest, which is most of the reason why Perez was on the podium. They went in when Red Bull should have sent Verstappen in, because he was in about ninth at the time, and it would have worked out much better. But, yeah, just a good strategy call. Really, from Force India, put their cars in decent positions, and it'd be Monaco. Once you're in the position, that's basically it.
Yeah, and that, I'm assuming similar strategy calls were able to put both McLaren Hondas in the points as well, with Fernando Alonso as high as fifth.
Kind of. McLaren were pretty strong. They had a pretty good qualifying. Alonso was in the top 10. I think he qualified seventh or eighth. So, wow. It was just it's a track which engine power isn't really that essential, so it kind of helps McLaren. And yeah, we know the chassis is pretty good, so Yep. It's been, at least it seems to be getting points on a regular basis now.
This is true. This is true. And also just out of the points is our hometown boys, men, I guess, whatever, for Haas F1 with Gutierrez in P11 and Grosjean in P13.
Yeah, like I say, Grosjean was doing better until he got blocked by Raikkonen.
Right.
So that was kind of it, really.
So now I need to watch the race so I can see what happens. I started to watch it the other night, and, you know, I was watching it in bed, and I got to, I don't know, about 15 laps in shortly after they brought in the safety car that they started the race under, and then I was out like a light.
I would have the fast forward, but not for quite a bit then.
Yeah, I did, but I was too tired to reach for the remote, actually.
They did bring in the safety car too late. It could have been a much more interesting race.
Yeah, it was a long safety car at the start of the race. I didn't understand that either.
I think they did like 6 laps under safety car before they decided to get going. Meanwhile, the drivers were on the radio saying, come on, let's get this started. It's fine.
Yeah.
Yeah, it'd been much more fun having a bit of... Because by that point, it was like almost complete dry line on track. It was like, yeah, that was the only fun bit that could have happened.
Well, yeah. All right. Now, I'm going to defend the... I'm going to defend the officials here. Keep in mind that if there had been nothing else going on and everything else was copacetic, that starting under in the wet, you know, doing the regular start, that would have been, from a racer standpoint, a fine thing to do. I mean, let the good drivers come to the fore and confront the challenging conditions, right?
Mm-hmm. Right.
But keep in mind that, what was it, the day before or 2 days before, the Bianchi family had filed suit against FOM.
Oh, that's
and
true.
The FIA and all that. And so, you know, okay, caveat. I'm a teacher. And 90% of the meetings I go to and the training sessions that I'm required to attend are on how not to get sued.
Yeah.
So, you know, there are things that you do because they're right and proper. And then there's things you do because you fear litigation.
Yep.
And with the timing of the Bianchi family suit and the conditions and all that, I understand why they did it. The purist in me says, come on, this is the pinnacle of motorsport. These are supposedly the best drivers in the world with the most advanced racing machines in the world. Let them deal with the wet. And if they can't, well, maybe they shouldn't be in Formula One. But, you know, I understand why they did what they did.
I understand them starting the safety car. I don't understand why it was out for so long, personally. But,
yeah, I think that's my point. Is I think after like lap 2, you know, a bunch of that water had already been pumped off by all the cars going through. It seemed like that just by the time that they went to release it, there was like there'd already been 2 good laps of plenty clear enough, and the weather was getting better. That was my only contention with it.
Well, at the point they actually started under the safety car, I don't believe there was any rain coming down. If there was, it was very light. I think I remember on the NBCSN broadcast, Will Buxton saying something. They went to him, and there was, you know, next to nothing coming down as far as rain. So it was just a matter of clearing off enough of the standing water for them to be able to, to bring in the safety car and let them run. So I agree. I think it should have been a much shorter safety car period. Okay, caution aside, there's no reason why they couldn't have shaved 2 laps, I think, off of that safety car period and, you know, had 2 more laps of green flag racing as a result, making for potentially a better race. And still had whatever safety minds or, like you suggested, Doug, any anti-litigation circumstances, you know, had the opportunity to prevent those. I think they could have done that in a much shorter time frame than they did. But, you know, I'm not in the booth either. What do I know, right? It just seemed very, very odd. It almost seemed like other races. When was it at Monaco? It wasn't all that long ago where there was a red flag and everybody scrambled and changed everything, and it just destroyed, you know, the climate of the race when they did that. But I think this may have been one of those calls or non-calls that that ended up that way. You know, really changed the dynamics of the race that way. But now I'll have to watch it and see if that's actually true. So. But we were busy. We
yes,
didn't get
you
a
were.
Chance to watch it because we were busy. Busy in the best kind of ways. So,
what were you doing?
Well, let's see. I'm the kind of crazy man who drove 2,000 miles total to go watch a 500-mile race.
I'm the kind of man that spent entirely too much money on airplane tickets to fly about 3,000 miles. Well, not quite that, but yeah.
Yeah.
To do the same thing.
Yeah. We're weirdos that way. So, but I don't think we would have done that, Mike, if we didn't have some other people in our corner. Would you agree with that?
I would very much agree.
We had gracious hosts in the Speedway, as well as our veteran cohorts, Mr. Patterson and Mr. Weitzel and Mr. Peachin, to show us the ropes, as it were.
Yeah. It was, you know, I from my standpoint, yeah, it was great to be able to arrive at such a iconic, you know, and historical venue and have somebody told me exactly, okay, first you need to go here, then you need to go this, you know, and have that kind of planned out for me instead of me just kind of just stumbling around in awe, you know, and not sure, you know, what I should be spending, what little time, and it's amazing how quick the time goes by. It really is.
Oh my
is.
God, yes.
Going from one place to another, and you really want to get the most value out of the time that you're there. I can see why they truly make it the full month of May or used to. I mean, it's hard to cram in all that is a part of what is this festival of speed. It really is in Indianapolis. It's fantastic.
So when you show up, can you feel sort of the weight of the event, the history of it, or is it just like a NASCAR race with hundreds of thousands of people?
Well, have you ever gone into the National Cathedral at Washington D.C.?
No, but I've been to Notre Dame. Does that work?
That works. Okay. And so you go into this cathedral, right? And as soon as you enter, there is this sense of place and presence, and I don't know how to describe it. It is like entering a church, you know. In a lot of ways. You enter and suddenly you understand, you know, the history and why this is so important. And well, to quote Little Al from 1992. You just don't know what Indy means, right? And you go into the Speedway, and you get that it is a cathedral of speed.
That's very well said. Yeah,
and there is this sense of awe, and you feel very small when you think of all the history that has happened here. You know, the 100+ years of racing. And especially what I feel when I enter, you know, now more so than I did when I first went in, is I think of the people that lost their lives mm-hmm. pursuing the passion of motorsport. You know, I think of Gordon Smiley, you know, I think of Dan Weldon, I think of, Justin Wilson, and Greg Moore, you know, and some of those guys, you know, they didn't pass away at IMS, but you know,
but still, you know, that
you
place.
Think about what it is,
yeah,
that these drivers are really risking, fundamentally to entertain us sitting in the stands, right? They do it because they have a passion for motorsport, and they have this passion for speed. but, you know, it is serious risk and danger that they're undertaking. And, you know, sometimes when we hear them complain about this, that, or the other, about safety, and we kind of heard this about the dome skids, right? And, you know, some people are like, oh, well, you know the risk going in. Well, I'm sorry, but you're not the one facing it, right? You're not the one literally putting your life on the line to go out there and do those fast four laps during qualification, or trying to be that one magical person out of the field of 33 that gets to drink milk. When you go into the Indianapolis Motor Speedway, the weight of that really does descend upon you, and it is a humbling and really inspiring feeling.
Now, from my standpoint, I'm going to actually back up just a little bit before even entering IMS, because yes, IMS had that same that weight kind of came on me of the history of the place, and like you said, of those that had that passed away. You named some perfect ones that were some of my favorite drivers that unfortunately have lost their lives, and at times I would stop watching the racing because they were gone, and because it frustrated me so. But yeah, you're right, these people love that stuff. But for me, it all started because this is the 100th running, and there was that added on top of that, right, that how special this event was. And I must say, when I got off that airplane and I walked right, right out of the terminal of where my airplane came off, and you got those moving walkways, mm-hmm. And right down the side of it was a giant thing about the 100th running of the Indianapolis 500.
Did you get to hear Jim Nabors?
About 8 different signs of everything from some local lawyer's place to, law office to some other business or whatever, that were using the logo of the 100th running of the Indy 500 and advertising it plastered all over the place. Promotion was at a premium for this. It was so well done. And then I come down the escalator to the main floor, and there is a car that they had there in the airport. The one that you see kind of signifying it's a mock-up of the DW12 with the 100th running all over it. And people taking pictures in front of it. And of course, down there were you guys, where I got to see you for the first time, which is cool.
Yes. Now, when John and I went in, as we were going down from the parking garage into the terminal, of course, they had Jim Nabors on recording, singing Back Home Again in Indiana. And I'm like, oh. You know, my heart melted when I heard that. I don't know if you heard that from the concourse.
Oh, I did not hear that. Unfortunate. But they had a classic, one of the old cars that had raced there, an old Cummins diesel Indy race.
Yes,
the old green thing that was up there on the concourse and stuff. And again, nice. It was just they had it all this stuff just kind of. Well, this is a big deal, right?
Right.
And to give you an idea, this is not a big airport by any means. Indianapolis is actually a much smaller city than I actually imagined it to be. If I was going to compare it to any place here in Oregon, it's probably the size of like Eugene or maybe Salem. It's not nearly
it's
as big.
What, around 350, 400, something like that?
Okay, yeah. So it's not massive by any means.
Possibly the size of Kansas City. A little smaller in Kansas City, I think, but not by much.
All right. But, so that was the first thing, I think, that was the first impression on me was just, wow, just there's something big going on here. And then, of course, it was that very next day when we went out there for Carb Day, and you directed us on where to go. And when you start driving up and you see the facility from afar, and it just starts looming larger and larger as you get closer to it. And you're like, wow, this place is immense, you know? The town
Speedway,
too.
People don't understand how big the place is. Dude, you right? have to walk it.
Yeah, right? I mean, you know probably better than anyone, Doug, as a photographer, you know, you wanted to get a shot from turn four, but then if you want to get back over to turn one, it's going to take you a while.
Yeah, yeah, you're coming 30 pounds of camera gear all along the way, right?
Oh, I know that feeling.
So, yeah, you know, going from turn four to turn three to turn two and then back to Gasoline Alley. Let me just say that after eating at Fogo de Chão and on the two trips that we took to the Clotta and all the track food and all that, I still lost a pound and a half over the race week. So, yeah, it is a lot of walking.
Yeah, certainly. It does definitely require a lot of walking. The nice thing is, you know, we got in there, John and I, and we got our bronze badges. John, unfortunately, I think, had an issue with some ID. Right, John?
Yeah, I did have a problem. I needed to have my wallet. I had everything else on me, sunscreen and, you know, wet weather gear and money and every. Well, no, I didn't have money because that was in my wallet. I had everything except my wallet, so I could not get to I could not pick up my bronze badge. So I had to scramble.
You need a checklist, sir.
Yes, I do. I need a tattoo, like on the back of my hand or something. So I had to take a probably overpriced cab trip back to the hotel to get my wallet and back. But the cab driver, admittedly, he was friendly. He was even sympathetic to a certain point, and negotiable, more importantly. So, yeah,
you weren't gone long. He got you there and back pretty quick.
He did. It was pretty quick. It was all told, what, about 45 minutes round trip?
Something ballpark? Like that, yeah.
Yeah, so, yeah, I missed some of the historic cars for 45 minutes. A little bit jealous, but that's okay.
Right, right. So, yeah, I mean, I guess when John was there with me anyways, yeah, we got our bronze badge, and for those that don't know, the bronze badge is what gets you in pretty much to anywhere within the facility every day but race day. You can get right to... you know, Gasoline Alley, you can, you pretty much go anywhere you want, other than on the pit lane.
Right. Any place that doesn't require other special credentials. You couldn't get into the pagoda with it.
Right. But. Exactly. But once we got that bronze badge and you're walking under, you know, that famous, entryway with all the flags up above it, you know, that says Indianapolis Motor Speedway, and
yeah.
Wow. You know, that's, you start walking, you just, and gosh, those grandstands are massive.
You know,
so much. And when you enter in on them, you're already halfway up, right?
Yeah. You know, I have
always down to the track.
I have, kind of a comparison, having been to Talladega and been in the stands in Talladega. And as far as this, the physical size of the track, the area, and that sort of thing, it kind of compares. But even despite that, there's something about Indianapolis, and maybe it's the layout, the other structures like the museum and the pagoda. Maybe it's the gravitas of Indianapolis. It feels so much larger than when I was at Talladega. It's weird to describe, but having essentially the free run of the place the way we did with the bronze badge was awesome, because you could see everything, right?
Yeah, we were walking up and down, past all the garages where all the cars are stored. And we were walking... again, we could go pretty much anywhere. We walked up to the pit lane, and what was the best part, honestly, to me, the yellow shirts, the people working there, all the volunteers were the most nicest, gracious. I mean, there's a madhouse of people there. Carb Day, they basically were saying that there was many people there for Carb Day as would have in past years been there on race day. That's how many people came to this event. So that was impressive. And everybody was still nice.
I'm glad to hear you say that. Yeah. And when I'm working the race, you know, as a photographer, I always make sure to get some shots of the yellow shirts doing work, because they do some really hard work and they have to deal with some real assholes. Right.
Yes. Yes.
And
drunk
like us.
Belligerent. Yes. No, we're not.
Also yeah. like us.
Well, no. I mean, even like, you know, orders of magnitude worse than us. Even
yeah. like drunk. Worse than the lady with the beer bong in the stands.
Oh,
behind,
my.
You know, I'm happy to hear someone else appreciate the work that they do. Now, that's not to say that I haven't run into the occasional yellow shirt is a little too power drunk.
Yeah.
But you're always going to get those kind of people, right? But by and large, man, they did a fantastic job managing the crowd, getting people moved around to where they needed to be, keeping people from where they shouldn't be.
Answering
which
questions.
Which is just as important. And answering questions, directing people. They did a great job. And fundamentally, I want to give a huge shout out to Doug Bowles. He's a president of IMS, and he has been working his tail off to both promote and organize this 100th running. And man, it could not have gone better. He did a phenomenal job of getting all
top shelf,
all the things in place, getting all the right people in place. And it just went fantastic.
You know, I heard an interview. Doug Bowles was being interviewed somewhere, and I don't remember what it is. And with all of the things that he was doing in the lead up to the 500, the interviewer asked him when he gets to sleep. Mm-hmm. He said June.
Yes. Yeah. Exactly. And you know, I think what it is Mr. Bowles. Fundamentally is a huge fan mm-hmm. of the Indianapolis 500.
Yes.
Of the Indianapolis Motor Speedway. I'm hoping to have, I'm going to request an interview with him later this month, hopefully next week. Well, let's see.
Wow, that'll
he's
be
got
awesome.
He's got an interview coming up, or an event coming up, the Vintage Race, right?
Right.
At IMS. That's an event I really, really want to get to. If you have the chance, if you're close enough to Indianapolis Motor Speedway, go to this event. Go to the Vintage Race and see some of these beautiful race cars do battle on the infield road course. Everything that I've seen, all the people I've talked to, all the photos that I've seen from my friends, it is an amazing event. But, you know, the work for him is not done, right? But he's done an amazing job at bringing in not just doing the IndyCar stuff, but really marketing the venue to a variety of different series and different racing platforms. The SCCA runoffs, the National Road Racing Championships for the Sports Car Club of America, at IMS in 2017, so next year.
I shared an article with you. I don't know. I think all of you saw it about the WEC has an interest mm-hmm. in possibly running an event on the road course there.
Yeah, so, they were there visiting during the 500 and just to see how well that they do things, and they were apparently very impressed.
Yes, and again, that all goes back to Mr. Bowles, because not only is he a fan of IndyCar racing, and especially the 500, of course, he's a fan of motorsport, including grassroots motorsport, and that's why I want to talk to him. I'm hoping to talk to him for it'll appear on the Camber Corner at formulaonblog.com. Cool. Hopefully, if he says yes. Crossing my fingers. Please say yes, Mr. Bowles, please. I want to talk to him about the grassroots efforts he's doing, you know, with the vintage racing and the tie-in with the SCCA. In fact, the SCCA chair, Lisa Noble, was there this year at the 500. She was over in the turn that temporary Turn 1 hospitality tent.
Oh, yeah.
Which is rave reviews, by the way. It was a very unique place from which to watch the race, and people loved it. Some of the people there on the pit side of the grandstands didn't love it so much because it obscured their view of the north, the south chute. People that were in that hospitality area really loved it, and Lisa Noble was one of those. In fact, I think here on Open Paddock in one of our Inside the Helmet interviews, I talked with Lisa Noble about her racing. So if you have a moment, dig through our archives, the Inside the Helmet series that I did, and take a listen to my conversation with Lisa Noble. So,
Professor Doug, master of the plug.
Absolutely. Yeah, but anyway, so, you know, man, he did just amazing work putting all this together, getting all the right people in all the right places, and wow, you know, I can't say that it went flawlessly, because no event of this scale ever does, right?
It can't.
I mean, you had a third of a million people in the Indianapolis Motor Speedway.
You know,
you nearly doubled the population of Indianapolis that day.
Yeah. Yeah, no.
And that's no hyperbole.
No, that's fact.
Doubled the size of the city, of the capital of Indiana, right? And so the logistics were huge. And to be honest, I think the only real bone of contention that many people had were the bathrooms.
Yeah.
You know, they just couldn't take all the, well, okay, I'm going to censor myself here. They just couldn't keep up with all the crap that people were feeding them. Right. And you know, it just ended up that, you know, some of the facilities were overwhelmed.
Piggly.
And working top notch, but you know, if that's your only thing, if that's the only problem with the event, man, that's a huge win.
You know, you were saying, you know, Doug Bowles being a fan of motorsport, and yeah, he certainly is. But even more than that, having met him and talked to him, he's a fan of. Sounds corny. He's a fan of. Enthusiasm, and specifically fan enthusiasm.
Well, you know, this goes back to what we were saying in pre-show, right? It's always about the people.
Yep.
You know, it's always about the people. It's not about the car. And we enjoy the competition, but fundamentally, any human endeavor, motorsport included, it's about the people. And Mr. Bowles gets that.
See, and Mike, at some point, he kind of, not so much made fun of me, but he kind of pointed it out. I'm walking around, especially on Saturday and Sunday, and I'm taking pictures of, excuse me, other fans. I'm taking selfies. They had these stickers that you could get where, you know, I'm celebrating my X of 100, you know? And of course, I'm wearing one with a big one on it.
Because you weren't the only one.
No, there was a lot of those. That's not anything to be ashamed of by any means.
No.
But I was every time I saw somebody with, you know, 33, 51, you know, trips to this race, I'm grabbing them and seeing if I can take a picture with them, because that's cool to me. I'm taking pictures of the groups of people who, you know, do this every year, kind of the way, you know, you and Weitzel and your group does every year, you know, and they have custom t-shirts made, whether it's a group of college friends or a family or, you know, whatever the situation is, you know, dads and sons tossing a Frisbee and a football, you know, in a spare patch of grass on Sunday.
Let me share
with
you.
Awesome.
Let me share with you a story of how I first came to attend the race. Now, I've been to the Speedway multiple times before this, you know, for time trials or just to visit. In fact, my very, very first visit was brought by my grandfolks in 1977.
Ooh.
And,
wow.
And it was magic. Of course, that was the year that the A.J. Foyt won his fourth, right? And mm-hmm. he's always been one of my heroes in motorsports. But that, unfortunately, that was also the year that we had a pretty tragic accident at Indianapolis that claimed life. And so I go to the Speedway and I enjoyed it. And I remember going with my dad to time trials and such. But when I was at KU, going to grad school, this was late 90s, I mentioned something about the race. And buddy I was talking to, he understood what I was talking about. And it took me just a moment to realize, wait a minute, I didn't say Indianapolis 500. All I said was the race. And you could hear through the inflection, the capital letters, the race, right?
What was that, Phil or somebody else?
No, that was my friend Steve Levina.
Okay.
A fellow graduate student there. And I'm like, holy crap, he gets it, right? He understands. So I started talking to him and find out he is the fourth generation of Levinas that have been going to the 500, right? Wow. And so in 2000, he invites me to go with his family. And he says, hey, we have an extra ticket. You want to come? I'm like, yeah, I want to come. And so they invited me into their tradition. And it was so humbling to be part of that decades-long tradition of going to the 500, right? And now his son, little Steve, is the fifth generation.
Wow.
Of Levinas to be going to the Indianapolis 500 mile race. And stories like that are just so amazing, right?
Well,
and
I think it's not just a race, it's a festival. It really is.
It is. It's a festival of speed.
And not even just that. I mean, as much as you, me, and all race fans enjoy it, but I mean, they make it a festival just for anybody. I mean, they do all that stuff on the infield with the snake pit and all that. I mean, there's cars going by at 200 miles an hour, 100 yards away from them. They don't even know who's in the lead. They could care less. But they do this thing where they just draw people in. And they know that the race is part of it, of course. But, yeah, it is about, I think as you were saying earlier, is that it is about just creating the special atmosphere, bringing people together. Right. Yeah.
Yes.
And you could feel that when they were doing the pre-race, all of the Memorial Day portion of the pre-race and recognition of the survivors from Pearl Harbor, the folding of the flag and the playing of taps. That was 350 some odd thousand people that stood there silent. Even in the snake pit in front of the DJ stage, it was just dead silent, showing reverence to those that certainly deserve it more than anybody.
You know, you guys were you guys were two sections away from us. You were in Stan J section 9. We were in Stan J section 7. But when Taps plays, I'm sitting here like Niagara Falls. Mm-hmm. Right. Because one of my very first 500, one of my very first, but one of the first few that I went to, my grandfather, who is a World War II vet, Purple Heart recipient, bronze medal recipient, he had recently passed away with full military honors at his funeral and all that. And the flyover that year was done in missing man formation.
Oof.
And so if you're not familiar with this, this is mm-hmm. four fighters fly over and one
peels off.
Peels off and goes vertical, right? Goes straight skyward. And I'm sitting there and I just sat down. I lost it, right? And so every year since then, when I hear Taps, it's just Niagara Falls all over again. Thinking of what our men and women in uniform do for us to allow us to be able to come every Memorial Day weekend to enjoy this festival of speed. And of course, now I sit next to my buddy Phil, who is a naval commander. And you guys met him on Carburation Day, right?
Yep.
Yeah.
And on, let's see, was it Carburation Day that he was there?
Yeah, he drove us there.
Yeah, okay. So it was Pole Day, which was Armed Forces Day. It was an amazing day, right? Because they always have an enlistment ceremony right there in the Pagoda Plaza, which is amazing. You know, it's so
right. That was the
so
weekend
cool.
before, right?
Yeah. And if you've never seen an enlistment ceremony, if you find yourself with the opportunity to go see one. They are really inspiring. but he was there in his dress whites, right? And I mean to tell you that the dress whites were better than a bronze badge. Because they got him right down there on pit lane during qualifying and all
he could
all,
do anything he wanted at that point, sure.
Yeah. he ran into this guy Gunny from Ray Hall Letterman Lanigan, and he was a former active duty Marine. I will not say an ex-Marine because there is no such thing, right? Anyway, he was a former active duty Marine. And he took Phil, latched onto him, and says, "I'm going to take your buddy. I'm going to take care of him." I'm like, "Man, you do that. I, you know, take him where you can, and just showed him a great time." And so, you know, the appreciation for our armed forces and on race day especially, the honor that they show those who have fallen in combat is really, really touching.
Yeah, very much so. It definitely got me a bit verklempt, which I was several times throughout the weekend. You know, this was something that Kevin and I had talked about doing. And, of course, he was there with you 3 years ago and unfortunately
yes.
is not with us now. So,
right.
Yeah, that had me – the whole weekend had me choked up for that. But let's talk about the actual race itself. We could reminisce for hours.
Well, I think we should start with qualifying on this one.
That's a good
because
idea.
Because that Mike. Was a great story in and of itself, was it not?
Yeah, it was. When it came down to the Fast 9, well, the Fast 9, of course, they said who determined who's going to be in there on Saturday. And then they actually run their Fast 9 shootout on Sunday. Which is the how they can extend the most mileage out of the fact that there's only 33 cars and there's no real bumping or, you know, impetus to, you know, keep running to try to qualify. But a lot of the drivers that you would expect to be in that Fast 9 weren't there. Montoya, Pagenaud. I don't have the qualifying results up. I've got the box score up, though, and I should see where people started.
Well, you know, here's the thing. You know, the two big teams that we always expect to do very, very well are Penske and Ganassi, right?
Yep.
Right.
Both of those are Chevrolet-powered machines or teams.
True.
And because of that, they also run the Chevrolet Aero Kit.
Let me throw this out there. They are allowed to use or not use different elements, right? So they can go out there and have a slightly different configuration.
But still, different elements from within their own manufacturers.
Right, from Chevy. Correct.
Okay. And so you look at the Chevy, and I wrote a piece about this. Tom, you and I wrote a little preview piece at FBC, right?
Right.
And I preluded our predictions with a section, It's All About the Aero, where I looked at the aero package from Honda and I looked at the aero package from Chevrolet. And the Chevrolet package on the front wing end plates and how they attach the rear main plane to the chassis, you know, where the primary struts attached to the rear wing.
Right.
Those were very, very different between the two manufacturers. And Chevy, I firmly believe Chevy got it wrong. They went way too complex on the front end and didn't give enough thought to the rear wing. Whereas Honda kept the front wing extremely simple, you know, following the adage, you know, simplify and add lightness, right? That's what they did with their front wing. Chevrolet did this weird front end wing plate with all these tunnels and channels within the end plate, right? You know, these inserts and stuff. whereas Honda just used a simple little diversion flap to get the air out away from the egg beaters that are the front wheels. But I think probably one of the things that helped the most was how Honda attached the rear main plane, the rear wing element.
It was kind of hanging down from underneath a strut that was kind of, I guess, like a hook shape.
Right, it's a gooseneck type of attachment, very similar to what we see a lot of sports car rear wings use. Right,
it's quite interesting that, isn't it? Because
Tom, go ahead.
Sorry. The design of it is from Wirth's previous sports car designs, which was the Arx Acuras. They had the swan neck style, so he's basically brought that into IndyCar, which is quite interesting.
You know, one of the things that people don't think about, you know, maybe they hear that a wing on a race car is like an inverted airplane wing, but then they don't fully understand exactly what that means in terms of the aerodynamics and how it works, right? The part of the wing on an airplane that does the majority of the aerodynamic work to produce the lift is the top part of the wing, right? You always see the engines. You never see an engine attached to the top of the wing, right? You want to keep top of that
wing. Well, not anymore because it's dumb.
Right. You want to keep that as clean as possible because that's where you're really accelerating the air, lowering the pressure to allow the higher pressure from underneath to produce lift. Of course, on a race car, you want the opposite. You want downforce. You don't want lift. And so Honda chose to use that gooseneck style from sports car racing to attach the struts to the top part of the main plane, keeping the underneath free and clear and aerodynamically clean, right?
That makes sense.
The other additional advantage is that allow them to, well, if you look closely at that rear attachment from the Hondas, that allow them to extend that gooseneck up a little bit to effectively create two vertical stabilizers to increase the yaw stability of the car, which is incredibly important as you're entering the turns. And this is, I think, where Honda had the huge advantage at Indianapolis. It wasn't because their engines were so much better than Chevrolet's. Of course they're not. But their aerodynamics were, and the cars were more stable, and they were able to carry more speed through the corners.
Well, there's also one more bit there that you didn't mention. When we're talking about cars, everything comes from the front of your car, right? So you actually touched on this a little bit. Chevy's front design, as in the front wing on those cars, it's very complicated. It's overcomplicated. But another word for complicated is draggy. Right. So when you create a very complicated design, you also make something that's you get a lot of turbulent eddies. Stuff just it doesn't flow cleanly. Right. And especially when you're talking about a high speed course like Indy, you want your front to be clean. That way, everything beyond that is clean.
Right.
You want to maintain as much as possible purely laminar flow over the rear element.
Definitely. Yeah.
You know, though, I think ultimately that definitely the aero changes or, you know, the aero package that Honda brought to Indy, it definitely aided them in qualifying, even through in practice leading up to qualifying when they turned up the boost. It was Hondas were consistently faster.
Yes.
Specifically on the non-tow report, right?
Right. Here's the thing.
And even on the tow report, too. So, you know.
Right. You know, here's the thing. And this is something that I try to explain to my students in solo racing is that, you know, it doesn't matter as much how much speed you carry into a corner. What matters most is how much speed you carry out of a corner.
It's all about
exit
corner
speed
exit.
Is everything.
Momentum.
You know, what is important is not how fast you go around the corner, but how fast you get from one corner to the next. And that I got from a quote from, I believe it was Mark Donohue, back in the 70s. And I thought about that, and I think about that as I'm doing a course walk, as I'm thinking about what lines I'm going to take through a course. And I think, what's going to allow me to get from this element to the next element as rapidly as possible?
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, with Honda having a lot more yaw stability, you know, with more laminar flow over the car and the vertical stabilizers there in the rear, I think it was in I would love to see the actual data. I don't know how I can get a hold of that. But I would love to get the actual data.
Should we plan a trip to Ohio?
well, yeah, I've already got a plan. The hotel is booked. but the thing is, I would love to see the data stream from Newgarden's car and from Hinchcliffe's car around for their fastest lap around the speedway during qualified, and look at what their exit speed was from turn two and from turn four. And I think that is where you'll see the difference between the two.
Well, if you look at the difference in qualifying between Hinchcliffe and Newgarden, the total time of the qualifying run was about 0.04 of a second across a, that's the entire time for the four lap run. The average speed difference was 0.06 of a mile an hour. So, I mean, they were very, very close. But something to think of. I'm looking at the qualifying results here. Out of the top, out of the first two rows, five drivers had an average above 230 miles an hour. Of those five drivers, one, two, three, four of them were Hondas. The only Chevy that was able to put together a 230 plus mile an hour run was Newgarden.
Mm-hmm. And I would bet dollars to donuts that with Newgarden, it was because of a shorter line. This is the other thing, right? You know, in order to do a quick lap, you not only want to maximize speed, but you also want to minimize distance. I remember, and I forget which 500 it was, but they actually had the positional telemetry from Dan Weldon's run versus Scott Dixon's run. Pretty much the same machinery, right? This was back when Weldon was a teammate with Dixon. And Dixon had run, I forget how many feet. It wasn't a whole lot of feet, but he ran a shorter distance around the speedway, given his line. And that's what allowed him to run a quicker time.
That would make sense.
And so I would bet if you looked at the distance traveled by Newgarden around the circuit versus all the other Chevys, that you would find that Newgarden went around IMS in the shortest possible distance.
That would make sense. Considering the comparative lack of pace, especially on qualifying day compared to the Hondas, that would be the only thing that you would be able to do.
Yeah, absolutely.
The only other... Really, as far as qualifying, I don't think we need to run down the grid, you know, the entire starting grid. The other notable thing from qualifying was Tagliani, who spun. It looked like he spun on cold tires, tried to catch it, but couldn't, and ended up actually hitting the end of the pit lane wall, the wall between pit lane and the race circuit.
Right.
Which was a nasty
wreck. I had been
wreck.
In turn four previously. Was I in turn four when that happened?
No, you said you were just there when I texted you.
No. it was like, that's my life.
Yeah, so But he was okay, and of course they were able to get the car together. The only thing was he was qualified with no time. No time recorded, which, I'm not sure how I feel about that. It almost seems, I understand because there's no other entries. Of course he's going to make the grid, but I don't know.
You know, and this is something I have a hard time understanding how this could be, right? The 100th running of the Indianapolis 500-mile race, and you struggle to get 33 entries. You know, we say what a remarkable event this was and how great that the management did, especially Mr. Bowles did. But ultimately, you only have 33? Really?
And Grace Motorsport? I mean, that was the big story in the lead up to it is Grace Motorsport couldn't put together a complete car to run.
Yeah, they had the funds. They couldn't get a car.
Yeah. Yeah. And that, you know, that's the killer, right? Is you know, usually the hard thing to find is the money, right? Money is always a hard thing to find in motorsport. No matter what type of motorsport you do, whether it's autocross, it's fundamental grassroots level, or club racing, or all the way up to the pinnacle. It takes cubic dollars to go racing, and the fact that they had the money and couldn't get the machinery, man, that's sad. Maserati Racing, I think they ended up with who is running the number 77? I'm on my second martini, so my memory is fading here. who is running the number 77?
Servia.
Thank you. Oriel Servia. They had eventually partnered with Sam Schmidt with Schmidt Peterson Motorsport, right?
Right.
but they were really looking to run Gabby Chavez in their own car. They had this huge campaign to try and find money to do this. Fortunately, Gabby did end up with a ride, which I'm very happy for. I mean, he really deserves to be in the IndyCar series. He really does. He's a great driver, a great kid. But, I'm really disappointed they couldn't get 35, 36 cars to try and contest the 500.
Well, the thing that I don't understand is in the lead up to May, back March, April, there were a number of reports, articles that both Honda and Chevy were prepared to, at least 17 engines apiece with the possibility we might have enough resources to do 18 to, maybe allow for a 35th car. Whatever, what happened in the last couple of months to change all of that? Even if they didn't, neither Chevy nor Honda would go above or beyond, and produce an 18th engine package. Even if they did 17 apiece, that's 34 and would have a pseudo bump. You'd have a ceremonial, let's kick Buddy Lazier out.
Man, he struggled all...
Oh, he did.
All month long, didn't he?
He did. But the gist of it is, whatever happened to all of their bluster about they're going to be prepared for the Indianapolis 500, when it came down to crunch time, when you've got teams that are ready to run and have the money and aren't going to do it.
Mm-hmm.
What does that say about their true level of commitment to the series, too?
Well, ultimately it's... For the manufacturers, it really is return on investment, right?
Yeah.
And I don't know. I'm not going to be one to lambast a business for not making a losing investment.
Fair enough.
As a fan, though, I was very disappointed.
I think that one of the bigger problems is that the manufacturers that are involved in the sport would consider producing more to make for a better show or to bring new teams. They would consider that a losing investment, or that it would be a losing investment to them. Does that make sense?
Yeah.
Okay.
Your coffee's ready.
Yes, it is. Yes, it is. And I need some of this Incendio liqueur into it too. So there you go. So anyway, for qualifying, we ended up with a pretty stellar front row with James Hinchcliffe. How huge of a story is it for him to have nearly lost his life here last year and then to come back the following year and not only be able to race, but to put it on the pole? That's a huge amount of redemption by anybody's measure.
Well, you know, of course, and it wasn't just a pole day. It wasn't just a pole day, you know, miracle.
Right.
He was fast during the whole week prior in practice. He was quick. He was the car to beat when it came to top end speed. And when Newgarden provisionally put it on pole on Sunday, it didn't look like anybody else had anything for him. Hinchcliffe,
except
was
for Townsend
last...
Bell, maybe, who had been like one of the fastest all week.
Well, okay, there's Townsend, but you know,
but Townsend Bell couldn't do it either.
But here's the thing, okay? So here's how it was playing out, and this is as a photographer who's looking to be in the right position to get that shot of elation when the driver realizes they won the pole, right?
Right.
And I'll tell you, I was not hovering around Townsend Bell's group, okay?
That's fair.
I was fortunate enough to be in the right place at the right time to catch Newgarden's team celebrating there on pit road as he just set some blazing laps, right? And they're cheering, and it looked like it was going to stick, man. It looked solid, and so I immediately ran to the and the crew was there at pit out, right next to where they had released the car, and so after lap three, when they were just cheering, I then began to sprint down towards pit in, where they were bringing the cars in to stop and then go take the ceremonial qualification photo right at the yard bricks. And so I was shuffling and jostling with I happened to be with on Twitter Field of 33, Mr. Paul Dalby. Many of you longtime IndyCar fans may remember from More Front Wing that he ran with Stephanie Walcroft. But anyway, I was next to him, and if you've ever met Paul, he's a tall drink of water, right? And I'm looking up at this guy, thinking, man, you have an advantage. You're like 5 feet taller than everybody else, man. Yeah, I'm sitting here holding my camera up above my head, hoping to get a shot, right? But anyway, I was next to him over by where Newgarden and Ed Carpenter were, and they were watching one person after another go by, and they're getting more and more excited, and the media was there getting ready to interview him and all that. And all of a sudden, Hinchcliffe puts down his first lap, and we're like, ooh. And then Hinchcliffe put down his second lap. And I'm like,
double ooh.
Double ooh. And I'm like, Newgarden, I love you, man, but I'm done with you right now. I'm going further up track. So I tried to get myself into position where I could capture Hinchcliffe once he got out of his car. Because after that second lap, I knew this is it. You know, his first lap was not as strong as Newgarden's. Newgarden put down an amazing first lap.
Newgarden was one of the few cars, the way he has his car trimmed out, that when he entered into turn one, I think he actually hit 240.
Yeah. And
I don't know if anybody else hit 240 at turn one.
Yeah, I'm not sure either. But, you know,
that was kind of the benchmark they were looking for on the TV broadcast anyway.
Right.
When you saw the lap times, though, for Newgarden, it followed very much like everybody else. You set this blazing first lap, and then you just dwindle down from there, right? But Hinch was much more consistent from lap to lap to lap. So his first lap was close to Newgarden's, but Newgarden's was faster than Hinchcliffe's. But the second, Newgarden's was almost as fast as his first, and definitely faster than Newgarden's. I'm like, okay, that's it. I know who's going to win pole now. And I think when that second lap time came by, I could see it in Newgarden's eyes. He did too. And so I immediately moved up track. And fortunately, I was in the right position. I ended up next to another extremely good photographer, friend of mine, Eric McCombs, who was the photographer for the Star Mazda series before it was taken over by Dan Anderson and became Pro Mazda. I was next to him there in pit lane, and we ended up being right behind the car after it had come in and stopped. You know, after the fourth and final lap. And I mean to tell you, it was a scrum. It was all asses and elbows, man. Rugby players have nothing on photographers. when it comes to a scrum, man. And I'm just very fortunate that I was able to get a usable shot. But yo, wow, what an amazing pole day that was to see Hinchcliffe just keep up the yeoman's work they've been doing all week long in practice, and put his number 5 aero machine for Schmidt Peterson Motorsport on the pole for the 100th running of the Indianapolis 500 mile race. It was really remarkable. It was a fantastically emotional scene, and it was so privileged to be a part of that.
Oh yeah, it was. You know, watching it on TV, it was, you know, the way that you described it with the, you know, Hinch's first lap and then his second lap, I don't know if I knew that he was going to get the pole, but it was obvious he was the only one who was certainly going to be able to contend. And the fact that he did, that was because it was so... just how close it was. I mean, the difference, you know, the actual time difference, you're talking 4/100ths of a second. I mean, that's hard to fathom over 10 miles, you know? Yeah, that's crazy.
And that's, and that was just qualifying.
That's just qualifying.
what a week it was, right? That was just such a great story to see Hinch get that though. I mean, he obviously just everybody was all hoping for it, really. I mean, after what happened a year ago, and you just can't make stuff like this up, you know.
Agreed.
The story wrote itself, and it was just awesome. And you know, again, all of those guys on that front row, I mean, they're great. They're great for the sport, and they all fought out to the very last, like you said, hundredths of seconds, and It was awesome to see that.
This will serve as a convenient cutting point for part one. In part two of this most lengthy of umcasts, we'll recap race day from the 100th running of the Indianapolis 500 mile race.